Hello, thank you for joining me. This is Ernestine Lyons, host of Quick to Politic, the podcast, the social commentary show that explores topics ranging from social justice to history, economics, small business, and of course, local and national politics. Thank you for joining me.
Recording. Okay. All right. Sweet. And now we are going to go ahead and take this live. The live does take just a little bit, so I'm probably going to go back and do some post editing. But
okay.
I'm excited.
No, me too. It's been a minute. It doesn't seem like it's been that long, but
I got to see. I mean, you could tell you all day. I probably need to. It keeps every time I try to take it streaming. It's twice. It's just like only me. So then when I'm live, people can't watch it, and it's nuts. Okay, so now I'm about to take it live, and I'm gonna share it once I introduce you, because it's gonna be hard for me to do both. Or no, it's not. Okay. All right, we're just gonna have a little bit of a delay, and live on the Facebook.
Sweet.
Okay, we are now live on Facebook. Welcome to a special edition, a Monday edition of Quick to Politic. I'm your host, Ernestine Lyons. I am a councilwoman, and I also work in the Michigan legislature. So I love to be able to delve into political topics. So this is the Quick to Politic, which is a social commentary podcast. And I also have the YouTube recordings that are up there. We're joined by a very special guest today. One of my favorite people, one of my former professors at Wayne State, Dr. Tariq Ramadan, Tariq A. Ramadan, and he's a Wayne State University professor of anthropology and Near Eastern studies, and has been working with immigration attorneys across the United States and across the country, testifying on immigration on behalf of respondents facing deportation to countries like Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, and other Middle Eastern states. So he wears multiple hats. He's, an amazing scholar. He made history so much fun and exciting for me as one of his students. I took modern Islam and Islamic civilization, Age of Empires with him. And, it's an honor to have you here today.
Oh, first and foremost, it's an absolute pleasure to be on your show. To one of the most incredible people that I know, Ernestine. You wear many more hats than I do, and so this is an absolute honor to be on your show. So thank you so much for having me.
All right. So yes. And I feel like I could talk about, just this was my undergraduate minor, Middle Eastern studies, and I also studied the Arabic language, and this was just like such a fascinating world to dive into. And so you study this. Let's talk a little bit about the Middle East in terms of strategic interests and to the United States specifically. And then talking about like oil and the 1950s and 60s, and focusing on the post-World War II, just World War II, and then life after that, getting involved in the United States getting involved in the Middle East, looking for oil.
Sure. So the 50s and 60s can be characterized by a sort of policy that was predicated upon containment. As the USSR became this sort of emergent power, and communism became a highly sort of influential ideology that was making inroads across, much of the map, there was this sense of urgency for the United States to contain the USSR and to prevent its spread into the Middle East. And so that's the contextual background, really, is to in order to understand U.S. strategic interests. They really kind of go back to, when we talk about the 50s and 60s, we're talking about an era, again, that is highlighted by the Cold War and by the emergence of Arab nationalism, which complicated things for the United States as well. And so interests were really sort of rooted in how do we prevent the USSR from becoming a major player in the Middle East. And so, of course, then you have the rise of Nasserism, you've got revolutions, all of which changed the political landscape in the Middle East in ways that made it almost impossible to have a uniform set of policies for the U.S. to impose or partake in the Middle East across many different countries.
Right, right. And when you talk about just a little background on like Gamal Abdel Nasser, that's like in Egypt. And so you have this, you know, coalition of a lot of, you know, just states in the Middle East and countries that are coming together to really find their sense of, you know, identity. And these were countries that were newly independent under either French, British, or, you know, some form of colonialism from a Western power.
Correct.
So,
with a few exceptions, but yeah.
Right.
With just a few exceptions, yeah.
Exactly. So specifically when we talk about like Iraq, you have a region that's referred to as like the cradle of modern civilization or the Fertile Crescent. And, you know, just the country conditions have seen a lot of turmoil since the 1990s with the first war, you know, Operation Desert Storm in the 1990s under George H.W. Bush. And right. Then you have more turmoil for Iraqis, you know, during the Bush administration. Tell us a little bit more about the ethno-religious backgrounds and the developments in Iraq, you know, just since, you know, the Bush administration.
Okay, if I can go back just a little bit and talk about the kind of the developments that occurred throughout Iraq's relatively short history. I mean, Iraq is only, by the way, right, 100 years old, right? It emerges as a result of the various arrangements that were made in the post-World War I period. And so, like you had mentioned, the British and the French decided to partition the Middle East, partition the region. And Mesopotamia, what was Transjordan, Palestine, become part of they become British mandates. And the British want to ultimately move their oil, which they would then use to run their ships, right? From transfer from coal to oil. And the best way to do that was really by connecting, Iraq, which had an outlet to the Persian Gulf / Arabian Gulf, all the way to Jordan and Palestine to the port of Haifa. And so there was strategic thinking on the British behalf to make sure these lands are contiguous from the Persian Gulf to the Red Sea to the Mediterranean. And so Iraq became really unstable in the 1950s. And some of that resulted from the revolution that took place, which ended the monarchy, which was a pro-Western British monarchy under King Faisal I, which became increasingly unpopular to the Iraqi people, particularly to the military. So you had mentioned Gamal Abdel Nasser, right? He's the champion of Arab nationalism. He tried in many ways to create a uniform, a sense of Arab unity across the Arab nation states, and was, depending on whose definition, obviously, was successful to some degree. But his coup brought him to power and ended the pro-Western monarchy in Egypt under King Farouk. And 6 years later in Iraq, we see a very similar undertaking, right? Military officers under Abdel Qasem ended up overthrowing the monarchy. And the next 2 decades are filled with coups and revolutions. And the instability that occurred in Iraq was worrying for the United States, because there was always concerns about, well, the pro-Western monarchy is gone. And so that opens up Iraq to potential influence by the communists and the USSR. And so that became a difficult sort of moment for U.S. policy in Iraq. There were concerns that something similar may happen in Lebanon in 1958. And so Eisenhower sent Marines to Lebanon. He didn't send troops to Iraq to counter the revolution that took place there. But it was undoubtedly incredibly concerning for Iraq. So in the mid-1950s, they created what you probably remember, the Baghdad Pact, which essentially supported the creation of this sort of barrier that ran from Pakistan to Iran to Iraq to Turkey, this sort of geopolitical wall, right, to prevent the spread of communism into the Middle East. And that ultimately gave way because, again, there were many shifts that were occurring politically, militarily in the Middle East that that hindered the ability for the U.S. to project its power in the region. So Iraq from 58 to 79 undergoes multiple revolutions, 58, 63, 68, 79. And so Iraq really never stabilizes. And the U.S. interest was to stabilize Iraq, at least in the 1950s, against the Soviet threat. So Iraq's history really is marred by a series of traumatic decades of bloody revolutions and revolts, right? In 58, the entire royal family was essentially gunned down in Baghdad. That wasn't the case in Egypt. It was a bloodless coup. Iraq saw a very, very bloody coup that saw the next, you know, several leaders, you know, die in various ways, leading up to the Saddam era, which brought a measure of stability, but brought all kinds of dictatorial carnage that comes with brutal authoritarianism. And your question was really about the kinds of conditions that occurred as a result of the first invasion of Iraq in 1991. Is that correct?
That's true. That's true. But then I kind of feel like you segued into like my other question, which was, yeah. You know, the United States was involved in, you know, just this the second operation that George W. Bush took on. And it was something where, you know, we were, because of 9/11, ending up going into Iraq, which really had nothing to do with it because of these claims of like, oh, there's weapons of mass destruction. And then right. There was only one actually substantiated claim that found there was anything even close to that. And it was just really, you know, I think it was really more of a strategic interest for the United States to go in because of our relationship with oil in the region. So, you know, that's kind of why I kind of segued into that from the first question, which is about oil strategic interest. And then, you know, when fracking became something that we were doing, it's like, oh, well, we've got our own oil reserves that, and that's a whole nother controversy. Balls,
right? Yeah.
So, but, you know, it's more about, okay, now it's not of strategic interest to us. And then before we kind of had an entry point where it's just like, we got a war against, you know, radical Islamic terrorism. So let's go into Iraq and also unseat this dictator. So that kind of leads me into, you know, just what was left behind, destabilizing the region, and then you're left with a void that then ISIS fills. And then, you know, you have these Shiite popular mobilization forces, and then you have, you know, these Iran backed militias. So let's talk about that, because this is kind of where I left off as a scholar and also living in contemporary times. You know, you grew up, you're a teenager in the 2000s. The Iraq War was a big part of like your friends. A lot of friends I went to college with went off and fight in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. So then it's a big part of just like who you are. So you're paying attention. And then, you know, we move into the Obama administration and the war is still ongoing, but then things start to de-escalate. But I think there was more of a, okay, well, things are kind of cooled down, or at least this is what most people stop paying attention at this point. So where do things come in? Like where that void, you have the region that has been, you know, a source of conflict for 10 years. And then now you have this void, and then ISIS moves in and all of these other, mobilization forces come in. So what has been going on in the region since then?
Well, really since the first U.S. invasion in 1991 in Operation Desert Storm, we saw Iraq had undergone a major conventional war against the Iranians for 8 years, from 1980 to 1988, right? And so and then 2 years later, and that decimated, that led to about 1 million people dead. There's still people missing from that war. And that war was devastating on Iraq's economy. It really, truly devastated Iraq. And Iraq never recovered from the Iran-Iraq war. So our strategic interests kind of shifted in the 1980s. We lent support to both sides in a way in which ultimately led to the weakening of both countries, but more so Iraq. And again, Iraq never actually was able to sort of reemerge as a power. By 1970, you know, scholars were predicting that Iraq would be a minor industrial power by the year 2000, and of course, Iraq emerges decimated from the war with Iran and is seeking money to sustain itself. Its oil facilities were bombarded and destroyed, and so it really had nothing. Kuwait became, you know, a serious issue, especially for the United States, who said that, well, you know, conquering Kuwait and acquiring its oil reserves would lead to Iraq essentially having, you know, almost a quarter of the world's oil. And so that was many, many powers, Western and then even including some regional powers, decided that that was not acceptable in any sort of way. And so that really begins a major American foothold in the region. That's the first time we saw a robust U.S. Militaristic long-term operation in the Middle East. And so you fast forward to the year, 2003, and we see the next major invasion, the next incursion, which is not just an invasion, but is actually an occupation that lasts for several years. I mean, technically from 2003 until 2011, when President Obama begins to withdraw troops. And so over the course of that time, since 2003 until today, like you mentioned, there are many, many moving parts and multiple dynamics and a really complicated political landscape in the country, which some people predicted that the U.S. invasion would lead to the sort of rupture of Iraqi society, but also the disintegration of its political sort of unity. Even though, and Iraqis would argue that even though Saddam Hussein was a tyrant and a brutal dictator, responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people, there was a measure of stability that came with the brutality, and that's what many Iraqis say. However, while that might be true in a very technical sense, Iraq has undergone an absolute nightmare and a disaster that probably was difficult for people to envision who already lived under the incredible brutality of Saddam. So we saw Iraq's political infrastructure essentially become had fallen into absolute ruins, especially with the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA, under Paul Bremer, who comes in 2003 and 2004, and essentially issues the policy directive, which is the dissolution of entities, which terminates all of Iraq's security and intelligence and military apparatus and infrastructure, which then leads to the absolute breakdown of Iraq's ability to sustain itself as a state. It sends hundreds of thousands of people home, people who, armed people who were, men in the military, right, police, intelligence, and what have you. And they all get sent home. And many of them become the basis for what are initially sort of resistance movements against American occupation, terrorist movements like Al-Qaeda, right, and then ISIS. And so you have an entirely new dynamic in Iraq that did not exist before. And so that came to fruition, that really came to a peak in 2014, like when you said, when ISIS becomes this this major player in Iraq, and really upends the kind of political dynamics that were in play in Iraq for decades, before that.
Something that can you hear me? Because when I press mute sometimes to keep some of this background out, I think you're still hearing me.
Like, I can hear you now. Yeah. For a second I couldn't, but now I can't.
Okay, perfect. It is okay. All right. So I have this new podcast microphone. And so it's reminiscent of the fact that, sometimes it's like strong men leadership is something that, some people just become accustomed to. And the same can be said with, like, for example, authoritarian leaders mm-hmm. in Russia. Some people are saying that, people got so used to having, maybe someone like a Stalin, a figure like that, in control, that, even though it was very brutal, very repressive, there was a system at least. And then, when you eventually down the line, you have a similar leader who has that kind of strongman dictator kind of tendency, like a Putin. Some people are just like, oh, we need that. We need to have that kind of level of guidance and leadership because at the end of the day, at least it's our own, we don't want to have someone come in and try to dictate our terms to us, especially having a Western power after, so many other states in the region had dealt with, colonialism and oppressive imperial regimes telling them what to do, and kind of being a little bit more pejorative and, just more, okay, well, we're looking out for our own self-interest and we're here to siphon, resources right. from the region. So I think it's kind of, you can't really say like, oh, well, this was terrible, but then you also, you dismantle other people's structures and then I feel like this was a tricky situation because the international community wasn't behind this. This was just the United States making unilateral decisions. And that's the thing I think that was the most problematic. But, I think having some history and then just kind of talking about that, that's something that was so recent as a part of our history. And, you know, that kind of rewrote the direction that, you know, I don't think that was going to be the direction of the Bush administration and the Obama administration of subsequently. I think there was going to be a whole different focus, but it kind of put us all into a different era in just history as a whole. And so it just kind of defined, you know, what we do in terms of going out and pushing democracy on people. And, you know, you had three administrations pretty much pushing this kind of, you know, in international relations, there's a term, you have, you have a realist, and then you have someone who's a liberal democratic institutionalist. And that's pretty much the last three presidential administrations, you know, from George H.W. Bush to Bill Clinton, then, you know, George W. Bush, then Obama. And I think then we kind of shifted back with under Trump having a little bit more of that, you know, okay, well, this is back to, you know, let's get away from international cooperation, which is strange because we technically weren't cooperating internationally. We were doing things unilaterally.
Right.
I just want to emphasize that point, that's something that as we get further and further away from it, I think that's going to be something that's a defining aspect of this era that we just lived through.
No, I think you're right. I think that going back to the first part of your statement, that there is a certain level of sort of, you know, comfort and capitulation to order. And I think that a lot of Iraqis, and again, you know, once you're removed from a particular sort of moment in time, it's easier to look back and say things were great back then. Things weren't great for the bulk of Iraqis under Saddam Hussein's regime, you know. But comparatively speaking, people make the argument that, well, this is far more horrendous. At least we had running water, we had waste management, we had, you know, hospitals that had, you know, medications. I mean, Iraq is really suffering. There's like shortage of well over 150 medications that, you know, people can't get. I mean, the level of corruption in Iraq is through the roof. I mean, it's incredible. I mean, there is somewhat, I think there is a there's the sort of reminiscing of a time in which there was at least, administrative and bureaucratic order in Iraq under that brutal authoritarian regime. And today's Iraq, you know, has elements of that authoritarianism, in that Iraq is still maintains that sectarian, flavor, you know, to its current sort of existing government. And so some things have changed, and yet other things haven't changed. So, you know, Iraq continues to be a very dynamic place. And I feel that, you know, Iraqis today are really curious as to what their country will look like in the near future, if their country truly represents a nation state anymore. And if Iraq as both an idea and as an actual geopolitical entity can remain afloat and can survive. Those are legitimate questions that Iraqis have today. And our policy with Iraq has, like you said, has mostly been unilateral. We've had very little support at the international level since 2003 onwards, except with the United Kingdom, which supported us for some time in our operations there. But
we also had Australians as well, you know, in the early months, you know, we're talking 2003-ish.
Yeah. It's become wildly unpopular today. And so, I mean, Iraq and U.S. troop levels in Iraq will be cut down to 2,500 by January, according to the current Trump administration, wants to cut down much of the... but we're still actively involved. We actually have many, many bases around Iraq. We're still engaged in Operation Inherent Resolve. We're still fighting ISIS along with the Iraqi security forces and the Iraqi army. And so there are regular attacks and assaults, mostly aerial strikes, against ISIS targets throughout Iraq regularly, weekly. So we still have an active footprint in the country. We are still, again, very much involved in Iraq's sort of the maintaining of Iraqi security to some degree, as we continue to assist the Iraqi army and also take on ISIS. And the Turks are also involved. The Turks have more or less never stopped bombing northern Iraq against PKK the Kurdistan Workers Party, which are, you know, regarded as a terrorist organization by many different regional and extra-regional powers. And so to this very day, the Turkish Air Force is still bombing northern Iraq. So Iraq's sovereignty, its sense of autonomy and independence is constantly being, you know, challenged by regional powers and extra-regional powers.
Right. And that kind of leads us to like the relationship with, you know, Iraqi Americans, yeah, and, you know, kind of leaving that region to come here, or maybe even having a longer history, but then seeing like their homeland and seeing, you know, a part of their cultural history sort of go through so much, yes, turmoil. You know, I just want to talk about like the vanishing of Christianity, okay, and the Chaldean population in Michigan. So in 2018, you testified on behalf of an Iraqi Christian man who was seeking relief from deportation to Iraq under a judicial standard referred to as something called CAT, or the Convention Against Torture. Let's talk a little bit more about, you know, just the dynamic as far as, you know, Islam and then Christianity and the Chaldean population there and here, and, you know, just a little bit more about the history.
So in response to the first part of your question, so in 03, I mean, Iraq has always been home to a rich tapestry of cultures and, as you know, ethno-religious groups and, you know, ancient historical religious communities, right? You've got a multitude of groups who are not Arab, right? Who don't see themselves as Arab. Many of whom have been Arabized because of various programs that were put in place by Saddam's regime in the 70s onwards. So Iraq is really diverse in its ethno-linguistic, ethno-religious makeup, right? It's home to not just Arabs, which are the dominant sort of ethno-linguistic group or cultural linguistic group, however you want to define Arabs. It's kind of a complicated term. Arab can kind of mean, it's meant different things throughout the course of history.
Like maybe some of my viewers out there, folks who are joining us, it's like Arab typically tends to be a cultural sort of attribute. You describe someone as culturally, yeah, you know, Arab, yeah, but then, you know, religion and other things are other titles that people take on. And you could be Kurdish, but then you're Muslim, right, or you could be Arab and then be Christian, or, you know, and so I think I just kind of wanted to make that distinction because in some ways it's very complicated. And I think that, you know, sometimes we don't necessarily understand all aspects of, you know, just identity, you know, even in the United States.
No, you're right. And I think that lack of expertise, you know, had profound consequences for policymakers who were focusing on Iraq, you know, during the invasion and the post-invasion period, right, the occupation period, is that we didn't have that many experts, right, or people that we had experts, but we didn't utilize them, right? We utilized people who really did not have a fundamental knowledge of Iraq's incredible diversity, who didn't understand Iraq's history, people who were part of the Bush administration who couldn't differentiate between a Sunni and a Shiite or an Arab and a Kurd. So that had profound consequences for Iraq and for policy towards Iraq. So, and I think it's important, like you just had mentioned, it's really important to decipher and to kind of like define some of these terms that we use, because Iraq has historically been, you know, home to many, many, many different cultural, ethnic, and religious groups and communities. And so, yes, while Arabs might constitute the single largest, you know, concentration of people in Iraq, it's home to many other non-Arab communities. And so, yes, an Arab can be Christian, Jewish, Muslim, atheist, agnostic, you know, what have you. Can be an Arab can have any faith, right? And the term Arab really is a much more, like you said, a cultural term, a linguistic cultural term. It's not really an ethnic term, because there are people of various ethnicities, right, who might utilize the Arabic language, be you know, sort of in tune with Arab customs, have that same sort of shared historical memory, right? And that's what it really comes down to. I mean, you know, like Benedict Anderson said, you know, what are, you know, nations, that they're these kind of imagined communities, right? Well, you never know everyone who's part of your nation state, but in your imagination, in your mind, exists the idea of unity, right? Well, Iraq had no political unity when it was created in 1921. I mean, Iraq consisted of essentially three separate vilayets or states to the Ottoman Empire. You had the Basra, Baghdad, Mosul. And they were administered differently, and they were oriented culturally and economically differently as well. And so Iraqis didn't ever constitute a single sort of cohesive political community prior to its creation in 1921 by the British, right? So it kind of lacks that sort of fundamental, you know, sort of nationalistic basis, right? But you do have this overarching sense of, for many Iraqis, sort of Arabness, which is cultural, which is linguistic, and it's also, you know, predicated upon the sense of historical memory and shared historical identity that goes back into history, right? Being able to refer to important historical figures that were sort of vital to that sense of Arab identity in the course of history. And so you can kind of harken back to literature and poetry and iconic people and individuals who were so sort of critical to the dispensation of a sense of Arabness over the course of time. However, that identity isn't shared by everyone in Iraq. You've got, like you said, Chaldeans, Assyrians, Syriacs, Armenians, all of whom are Christian for the most part, right? You also have the Shebeks, you have the Yazidis, you've got the Kurds, you've got Turkmens. You have, again, you have Arabs, you've got Sunnis, Sufis, Shiites. You have really an incredibly diverse population, which is culturally oriented, you know, towards very differently. But there were efforts to Arabize them, to create, right, to impose a sense of Arab-Iraqi identity amongst the entire population. Many groups resisted. Right, I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
No, it's the same. Like I you know, remember reading about the history of, you know, just certain Native American populations trying to, you know, they would try to Americanize and, you know, strip them of a Native American identity. Yes. And just make sure that they knew American songs. Yeah. And they only spoke English and they didn't learn the Native languages, and they didn't, exactly, they had very anglicized names. And so, you know, this is something that is a trope throughout history where you do try to eradicate somebody's cultural. And even as an African-American, I feel like that's the biggest thing about bringing, you know, enslaved Africans here to America. It's like, you have no shred of connection back to the identity that you originally had, right? Because now you have this American identity, American last name, American everything. But then none of the American citizenship initially. And so, you know, that's something that, you know, we'll see time and time throughout history. And I think this is why it's important to really study history so that you don't let things like this repeat themselves, but they do.
They do because for occupying and colonial powers, it's a strategy that's been proven and it works, right? The erasure of history, the sort of imposing of a new cultural order in the way that you envision. And so you're absolutely right. You know, I always ask my students, it's interesting you bring this up. We try to hammer in my intro to anthropology classes and also my Arab society classes. We ask, you know, what constitutes an American? Outside of a juristic definition, right, that is predicated upon citizenship, what is an American? How do we qualify Americanness outside of a legal context? And so we always have these really fascinating discussions, right? Because at the end of the day, these national identities are really kind of ambiguous and spurious in many ways, right?
And I feel like that could be we need to have another podcast episode that just
should.
An identity, and like, because I do a lot of international traveling, and you know, they'll see, like, I'll have interactions with, you know, folks who are native to, say, Slovenia. Yeah. And they'll see me and two other Americans, and we're all as different as day and night, different, right, religions, different colors, different, you know, just regions from the United mm-hmm. States. And like, okay, well, what is the underlying thread that connects all three of you, even though you seem to, you know, outwardly, and even, you know, inwardly, like, different, you know, just philosophies and perspectives on life. Yeah. You know, what is that thing that makes you all American? So,
right. Yeah. What is that unifying, bonding sort of component that we all share in? And I think that can be very difficult in trying to identify, right? Because there are sort of multiple overlapping historical memories, right? There are multiple identities. We stress different aspects of our identity. I mean, one thing about Americans is that we tend to be, And you can even obviously apply this to Iraqi society as well. I mean, we are a pretty fragmented country. We are still rather segregated in terms of the American demographics. And you look at major urban centers and where people sort of live. It's not coincidental that there is a sort of a hyper degree of segregation, right? People tend to live among people that look similar to them, right? In the most outwardly phenotypic way.
Subcultures, like the, you know, because, okay, yeah, you're all American, but it's like, right, there's a subculture, you know, there's Italian Americans, there's African Americans, yeah, there's, you know, Polish Americans that are separate than, you know, someone who came here from, say, Poland or Italy. And it's like, really, but then people are still going to cluster together. They're still going to find people and even the same socioeconomic background. You know, even things that I've found, like, sometimes for me, it's even like a disconnect between certain things that I belong to because of, you know, maybe even education or you know, what I've been exposed to, you know, growing up in a certain area. So, yeah, that's definitely something that does determine, you know, this is a question that wasn't even written, but I think we've kind of segued into something that, you know, is an important part of, you know, identity and why people want to fight to preserve that. And why people, you know, just for example, you take the Arab Spring and how, you know, there was just so much unrest because people really wanted to be able to, you know, have their own sense of identity. And then you had this mobilization that also went with having exposure to social media and having a voice that, you know, couldn't be suppressed. So, but yeah, I digress. I'm going to get back to the where you left off at.
No, that's a perfect segue because I think a lot of what we're talking about is also applicable to Iraq, because Iraq, like the United States, is home to many diverse, you know, communities, right? Be they, you know, linguistic, cultural, religious, what have you. And so I think in that regard, the same kinds of pressures are there. And I think the same kinds of concerns are there. How do we express our identity and preserve our own culture without having to conform to or subscribe to this dominant culture, which is being imposed upon us, right? And I think that that can be applied to many different nation states, right? It's one of the struggles I think that people around the world have residing in these you know, what is a relatively new geopolitical kind of invention, right? The nation state, right? Being tied to a particular sort of, you know, physical place, and being united under this sort of ambiguous and sort of, you know, this ambiguous sense of sameness that means different things to different people.
That's arbitrary. I mean, like, what is sameness? It's the sameness as we have a shared literature. Well, then for that matter, I should have more in common with British people who live in Cornwall because we speak English. But it's just, you know, it's very, you know, like you said, it's arbitrary, and it's also, you know, just something that, how do you, it's really nebulous. How do you define things? So
it's truly, and it's still, I think it's still very difficult to come up with, you know, cohesive definitions or, you know, to qualify these very ambiguous terms. And so I think the same, we're seeing the same sort of trends in Iraq, right? There's the various, you know, ethno-linguistic and ethno-religious groups, they are, for a long time, they wanted to express their sense of self-identity that was detached from maybe the Arab and Muslim identity of the country. And so we've seen the lack of tolerance by groups like ISIS. We saw this even under the secularist, Ba'athist, you know, regime in Iraq under Saddam Hussein, right? We saw it then with the existing government, all of which have tried in various ways to impose their own kind of political vision for the country, which is attached to their own identity themselves, right? And so, you know, the Kurds have been suppressed. After 2003, the various smaller minorities have been suppressed, right? The Shabaks, the Yazidis, right? Some Arab Sunnis. The Arab Shiites were repressed under Saddam Hussein. And so the Kurds have been at war, right, with the Iraqi state for decades. And so, while they've been able to acquire some autonomy in Iraq, they are not independent. They are still part of the nation state of Iraq.
I do want to interject here and ask, like, about you know, the Kurds and you know, looking at historically, like, Kurdish individuals who, you know, have a, you know, Kurdish ethnicity and, you know, that culture. There's also this sense of suppression, and, you know, this is a culture that's really ostracized in other parts. I understand in Turkey, there's also, you know, just a sense of, you know, okay, well, no, we're gonna, you know, I don't know why I'm trying to think of a word that, like, kind of expels people. It's like a
pogrom. Like a cultural genocide of sorts?
Right. Yes. Oh my God. Yes. What is it that makes people, you know, I don't know. I think this is another segue, but, you know, I know that the Kurds have been under a lot of scrutiny, and, you know, they were persecuted in a lot of regions in the Middle East.
Yes, the Kurds have endured, you know, suppression at the hands of various governments over the course of time and across time and space, whether it be in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Turkey, where that's the largest concentration of Kurds in the Middle East. Because, well, the Kurds were promised statehood as a result of the Treaty of Sevr in 1920, which didn't materialize because Kemal Atatürk was able to preserve, you know, sort of Turkey's independence while fighting off the various colonial powers. And so he resisted acknowledging the Kurds as a separate, you know, ethno-linguistic community, referred to them as Mountain Turks, right? And in some Middle Eastern states, you know, even citizenship was not extended to many of the Kurds, some of whom were secessionists and wanted to express their sense of identity in a political way by trying to acquire statehood. But no country in the Middle East is willing to forego territory or resources, you know, on behalf of the Kurds who are trying to demonstrate their own autonomy. No one's willing to give up anything to make the Kurds happy. And so they've in various instances have launched their own campaigns at being acknowledged and recognized as separate. So not all Kurds are separatists. Some have, you know, have conformed or subscribed to the sort of the national ideologies that aim to frame their sense of identity and link it to the broader Arab, you know, Muslim identity that is dominant, at least in places like Iraq. But the Kurds sought independence via referendum in 2017 in Iraq, and in the Iraq proper, if you want to call it, said no. In fact, they engaged with them militarily in Kirkuk and took back this disputed oil-rich city and prevented the Kurds from becoming an independent nation state. So Saddam Hussein and the Iraqi government under Ahmed Hassan al-Bakr in the 1970s went to war with the Kurds. I mean, decimated Kurdish, you know, towns, villages, you know, northern Iraq. And then, you know, also under Saddam Hussein, they also engaged in a campaign to essentially commit what is called cultural genocide, really, is they tried to dilute the Kurdish demographic makeup of northeastern Iraq by relocating Kurds, but also by moving Arab Muslims into Kurdish areas. So if they weren't willing to subscribe to an Arab Ba'athist ideology where Arab identity was really central to the Iraqi state, then they found other means to make them conform, whether by bombing them, whether, you know, or whether by actually engaging in cultural genocide, imposing the Arabic language, and stripping them of their own identity. They engage in all sorts of processes to do that. The same with the Assyrians, who, again, really remain resistant to this idea of Arabization. Many of the Chaldeans in Iraq, for example, those who left the villages in northern Iraq and the Nineveh Plains and who migrated to Baghdad became much more Arabized, adopted Arabic names, adopted Arab culture and customs, and adopted the Arabic language and passed it down to their children. So they became more Arabized. They assimilated more than other groups in Iraq over the course of time. Many of them left the country. I mean, Iraq is not a safe place for Christians. Going back to your previous question, by 2003, there were about 1.5 million Christians in Iraq. Today, there's probably about 250,000 left. And if there was a precedent set with Iraqi Jews, which really don't exist anymore, you could probably count that number on your hands, on your fingers. So there's precedent for the complete annihilation of an entire community. ISIS was not just, they didn't just target, for example, Christians in an actual physical genocide. They also destroyed much of Christian and even pre-Christian Assyrian and Chaldean heritage in Iraq too. So there was a campaign to really wipe out that entire community's existence in that country.
Right. And that's something that, you know, even in China, I remember, you know, reading about how during the Cultural Revolution, there was an attempt to, you know, just undo the country's past. You know, they wanted to get rid of the four olds, which was imperialism. You know, it was having an emperor, and, you know, it's just like destroy all of that history and wrap, you know, wipe it out, because the only history that matters to us is communism. And so it was just, you know, it's something that, you know, we see time and time again. And so I think, you know, just kind of wrapping things up here, yeah. I kind of want to draw parallels to, you know, just some of the the identities that are wrapped up in people's struggles to really, you know, it has to be really, really tough to have such an oppressive, you know, system imposed on you, you know, to grow up in Iraq, you know, over the past, you know, almost 20 years since, you know, these conflicts that have been going on, you know, what does that really look like for, you know, just Iraqis here, you know, Muslim and Christian alike, you know, and, you know, just kind of watching things sort of go through so much transition. It's like you have, you know, one regime come in and then you have a void and a vacuum and then somebody else comes in and then maybe the last thing is worse than the thing that replaced it. And, you know, how do you just, you know, as an American, like, what do you do? And, you know, what are some of the conversations that you have with, you know, fellow vested individuals who are, you know, Iraqi, who, and I do want to make the distinction, like you have Jordanian heritage. And so I just want to make sure that, you know, folks out here listening, you know, it's just really, it's more of a, from a scholarly perspective, you know, what is the understanding out there?
Yeah, no, that's an excellent question. And I think because in my own conversation with Iraqis, you have, you know, competing kinds of ideas about what constitutes an Iraqi. You also have people who have dissociated themselves entirely from Iraq as a result of what has happened in the past, you know, 15, almost 20 years now. Your previous question was really about how these various factions have come to Iraq and have, shaped or reshaped the kind of the Iraqi society. You talked about ISIS and the PMF, right? ISIS mostly subscribed to this hyper-conservative, Salafist brand of Islam, a puritanical, absolutist form of Islam. And then you have, for example, its counterweight in the PMF militias, the Popular Mobilization Forces, which are predominantly Shiite armed groups. Both of these groups had their own kind of political vision for Iraq, right? And have tried to mold Iraq, or at least segments of Iraqi society, in the way that they see fit, right? In both cases, they do see Islam as their interpretation of Islam, I must say, as a fundamental source of identity, and both have been trying to impose their will and their own kind of version of Islam on their societies. Although, when you look at both groups, there are obviously other goals and achievements, right? There is an economic component to it, right? I mean, many of these groups acted as if they were very mafia-esque. They ran criminal organizations as well, right? Or sort of organized crime, and they did many other things, right, outside of their sort of armed operations at attempting to subdue the, you know, various sectors of Iraqi of the Iraqi population. But they both have their own vision for what Iraq should look like, both ISIS and the PMF militias. And so the Christians began fleeing, as did other minorities after 2003, when you began to see the rise of these armed militant factions who were extremists and fundamentalists. Some were religious and others weren't. If you look at ISIS, the top brass of ISIS was mostly composed of like ex-Iraqi intel, right? People who had the task of running a state security apparatus. And that's why ISIS was so, at least at the military sort of level, successful, because the guys who were running ISIS were guys who ran the sort of security operations of the Iraqi state under Saddam Hussein. And now you have a similar kind of current amongst the PMF militias, which you have people who, you know, have a history of combat. And so both have had the effect of really suppressing the self-expression of these various Iraqi, you know, communities. And you've seen the fleeing, right, the large-scale fleeing of these different minority groups and to all parts of the world, whether it be, you know, neighboring Jordan, whether it be to Europe, Australia, or the United States. And they're creating these new kinds of diasporic communities, some of which remain sort of attached to Iraq in some sort of kind of imaginative way, right? And then others who have said, well, I don't see myself as an Iraqi anymore. In my own conversations with people who have roots in Iraq, there is a sizable group who see themselves as Christian, as Chaldean, as a Syrian or Syriac or Turkoman or Mandaean or Shabak or Yazidi, what have you, and don't see themselves as Iraqi, especially this new generation who've never been to Iraq or who left as a child or don't really have any, or associate Iraq with these Islamist militias. So they don't really see Iraq as part of their own identity anymore. It just really depends. I've had different conversations. I've had people who I've talked to who were Chaldean or Assyrian or Kurdish or, you know, Arab, and who say, you know, I'm Iraqi, you know, I belong to this particular ethnic group, religious group, and others who are disconnected entirely from Iraq. They may speak Arabic, even with an Iraqi dialect, but Iraq is something that they haven't endured, and they've only seen play out on television, and it's been associated with violence, carnage, and with terror in their minds. So, yeah, there are, again, competing kinds of conceptions of what Iraqi sort of nationhood can, you know, consists of today. And the other work I was doing was, yeah, I work with all kinds of immigration attorneys who, you know, I testify on behalf of Iraqis who are facing deportation to Iraq, because Iraq is such a profoundly dangerous place for minorities and for people with certain kinds of qualities and characteristics, be they political ties or history and things like that. So I've been actively involved in cases, and many of which have been successful so far, and keeping them here rather than having them face things like torture or worse in Iraq if returned.
Oh, wow. So this has been a really insightful look into, you know, just a world that we were really, really just like enveloped in this conflict. And then now it just seems like the average American probably isn't paying attention to this anymore. And, you know, just even going back to the whole strategic interest, it seems that it's not such a hot button issue, but then people's lives have been upended. And you know, life will never be the same. And I know that there are a lot of people, you know, who are here, a part of the Iraqi American and, you know, Chaldean American population who want to, you know, be of assistance, you know, with business and, you know, just kind of, you know, helping repair and helping rebuild and create a new life. But then also a new identity is forming from a lot of immigrants and refugees who have had to flee the area. So thank you for shedding light onto, you know, such a you know, just a really, I think it's as a topic more of us should really be aware of. And this is why I really got into the field of international relations, because, you know, we really need to pay more attention to the world around us, especially because, you know, here in Michigan in particular, we are a melting pot. We have the largest Arab population outside of the Middle East. And so, you know, it's just really important. And thank you for, you know, adding your perspective to this conversation and for coming on the show. I have been saying ever since I started this podcast, I'm like, hey, you want to be a guest on my podcast? And I think it was last year around this time, you're like, yeah, sure. But that was like, I think things were harder pre-pandemic, even though it sounds odd to actually get people together. And then versus now, you just jump together via Zoom. And yes, you know, that way you can have these thought-provoking conversations, and you will be back on the show so we can talk a little bit more about, you know, culture and identity. So I think that's, you know, a really important conversation to have as well. Also, who was your favorite student at Wayne State, you know, way back in the day? So, and the answer is Ernestine. It's,
absolutely. There's one Ernestine.
Yes, period. There are no other Ernestines unless they're 90 years old.
One of one. So I like that. No, I appreciate this. This is long overdue, and I thank you so much. And I'm totally honored and totally flattered to be on this show, and I'm glad that we were able to talk about this. I feel that we've been invested in Iraq for so long. I mean, Iraq has been on the radar. I mean, we, you know, since I was a kid, during the first time that, you know, the U.S. invaded Iraq, I had, you know, It's been at least at the forefront of all kinds of conversations in my own household for the past, you know, 30 years. So I think that Americans should have a better understanding, an enhanced understanding of Iraq. And I think that this opportunity was a great cause. And I think that hopefully people who are listening can walk away with something. So I do appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
Yes. All right. Well, we're gonna thank you for us for the audience out there. I got a lot of really great comments and folks who are joining us, and you know, just a lot of eyes on it and questions and comments. So thank you so much for watching out there live on the Facebook. And so now we are going to stop the live stream. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
And in the recording, bye YouTube. Like, comment, subscribe.